Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1978, a message about a new word processing system went out to about 400 users of ARPANET. That's the U.S. government-sponsored progenitor of the World Wide Web. It was the first example of a new form of advertising, one we now know all too well as Internet spam. By 1978, the Mad Men era was snuffing out its last cigarette, the seeds of ultra-lucrative celebrity endorsements were bursting open, and dawn was about to break on the days of digital. That same year, Adweek launched. The publication is marking its 35th anniversary with 35 years that changed advertising. It's a slideshow of some pivotal moments in the history of the industry. David Greiner is contributing editor at Adweek. And David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Do you have an idea of what advertisers think is the greatest ad ever?
Typically, the greatest ad honor goes to Apple's 1984, which actually first ran in 1983 in the last few seconds of the year so that they could squeeze it in for award show consideration the next year, but kind of redefined what the scope, the cinematic kind of depth of advertising that was possible.
Let's play just a little bit, directed by Ridley Scott, the Apple 1984 ad, as it's known.
We shall prevail.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
Tell us, David, what was going on in that ad?
Well, that was the launch of the Macintosh, obviously one of the most kind of iconic turning points of the computer age. And in the ad, we see this very 1984 setting, very drab, drone-like crowds watching a large screen with a Big Brother-type figure, and a heroic, colorful Apple-representing figure comes running down the walkway and throws a sledgehammer at the screen, shattering it, and then fades to an announcement of the Macintosh coming out that year. And really was kind of one of the first ads to seem that dramatic and, like I said, cinematic, almost like a short film.
And we learned from your slideshow or your retrospective that Apple's board was originally against the ad.
Yeah, the 1984 ad came at a really awkward time for Apple. The board was trying to drive out Steve Jobs. It was a very divisive time at the company that was trying to figure out what they wanted to do. And the board did not want them to run this ad. They were firmly against it. And in fact, there have been some stories since then that the agency and Steve Jobs kind of colluded to ignore these repeated requests to not run the ad and slip by and got it into the Super Bowl anyway. And of course, it almost immediately became one of the greatest ads of all time.
Apple is kind of a frequent flyer in this retrospective of 35 years of advertising. You point out the 2003 campaign for the iPod, that black silhouette with the white earbuds. Also, we hear again about Super Bowl ads. Tell us about the origins of the quote-unquote Super Bowl ad.
Well, the Super Bowl really hadn't become known as the place for amazing advertising until the early 80s, and we really saw that in 1980 with the Mean Joe Green ad, the kind of famous Hey Kid, Catch ad that created this idea of blockbuster advertising.
I just want you to know, I think you're the best ever.
Yeah, sure.
Want my Coke? It's okay, you can have it.
No.
Really, you can have it.
Okay.
A Coke
Thanks.
And a smile makes me feel good.
How much of these sort of play on an emotion? Is that part of the thing that works with advertising? Something that flips your idea around?
I think a great story, a great character is really the recurring theme that I found going back. I'm only 36 years old, so going through 35 years of advertising was kind of an interesting process. But what we saw is great characters really become as iconic, sometimes even more iconic than great slogans. And I think we still think back to that moment with Mean Joe Green. Now, he's a real person, but then obviously we think back to a lot of the fictional spokespeople as well, and the real-life spokespeople, the Lee Iacocca's, the Dave Thomas, Wendy's. Those characters, those people ended up being something that everyone could latch onto in their minds and think back to and really become kind of our strongest memories of advertising.
That is what's so interesting. Flipping through this, I was thinking, oh, excuse me, do you have any Grey Poupon launched? And, you know, where's the beef and got to make the donuts and that kind of thing? These are all part of our cultural vernacular, or they certainly were for a long time, and many of them last long after the ads are off the air.
Some of the best slogans are the ones that keep enduring long after they've officially stopped running. Where's the beef probably is the iconic slogan for advertising, and it only ran for less than a year. Within a year, they had decided that it wasn't supposed to be a slogan. It was just supposed to be a punchline to one ad for Wendy's. But it caught on. There was a song on the radio. It became such a big thing. It was used in the presidential debates and became such a cultural phenomenon so quickly. But within a year, they had decided, well, that's not our slogan. We're going to move on to a more official slogan. And then they kind of floundered around for years trying to find something as compelling as that. But meanwhile, that slogan survives to this day. It's something that even kids who weren't around when it first aired are still quoting.
Where's the beef?
Some hamburger places give you a lot less beef on a lot of bun.
Where's the beef?
At Wendy's, we serve a hamburger we modestly call a single. And Wendy's single has more beef than the Whopper or Big Mac. At Wendy's, you get more beef and less bun.
Hey, where's the beef? I don't think there's anybody back there.
You want something better.
That was Wendy's Where's the Beef ad from 1984. We're going through some of the most important moments in advertising in the 35 years that Adweek has been covering the industry. David Greiner is with us. He's a contributing editor at Adweek. Well, David, if the Apple 1984 commercial was among the most successful, any big disasters in your record of 35 years?
Well, I think the bar for disaster was definitely set by the launch of New Coke, which up until then, any child of the 80s remembers New Coke extremely well, because it had seemed up until that point that Coca-Cola could do no wrong, that Pepsi would always be the number two, that despite a lot of growth, they would just never catch up to that. But the reality was that Coke had been feeling the pressure of Pepsi, which is a little sweeter and had a little more pop culture appeal. And so they tried to appeal to that by making their formula a little sweeter and then also getting a more hip and trendy young vibe for their advertising. The whole thing was an absolute disaster. It was just a perfect example of not knowing what people wanted from you.
Attention Pepsi drinkers, introducing the new taste of Coca-Cola, the best Coca-Cola ever. That's all I'm going to say. In fact, that's all I have to say. No more words.
When Adweek started in 1978, it really does feel like we're in a very different era than we are now, when digital media, social media, online media have taken advertising in all sorts of new directions. So what do you identify as the kind of turning point to a different way of telling stories in a different medium?
Well, it's hard to pin it to one exact moment or even one exact year, because it was this gradual rise of digital, of brands, and this idea of creating a brand was still a very new concept, and now it's something that even for those, you know, normal people who don't work in advertising, don't sit around thinking a lot about it. But when we think of Nike, we think of just do it. When we think of milk, we think of got milk. These are very carefully crafted brands that go far beyond a tagline. And they really, in my opinion, didn't come to life until digital really came along. And again, that was the slow process over the 90s, especially, where suddenly you don't have to wait for commercial breaks to interact with these companies. It starts to become just part of your daily life. And now, obviously, for better or worse, that's kind of the world we live in, where we're surrounded by companies and brands and messaging. And sometimes that's good, and most of the times that's obnoxious.
Well, you also point out in this digital onslaught in 2008, Facebook sort of stomps on MySpace, which had just as much promise as Facebook had, but different kinds of leadership. Yes, huge story. But what does it still mean for advertisers, David Greiner? Of course, we are seeing 30-second web ads that some people wait all the way through, some people don't. We're still stuck in the banner ad era to some degree. Will advertising ever be able to regain the kind of force that it had in the, let's say, the golden age of television?
Well, I think what's interesting is reading up, when I went back and really read into the origins of Google and Facebook, both of them, and this kind of famously came up in the Social Network movie as well, both were very anti-advertising and really did not want it to be a big part of the experience. The founders of Google were really worried that advertising would sway the search results and would be kind of the opposite of what their users wanted. And I think what's fascinating is those two grew to be pretty much the largest advertising mediums on Earth. So I think we've kind of seen this new golden age arise where it's less about the gigantic ads and the big expensive ads, and it's more about the quantity. For advertisers, that's a good thing. For most of us, that's a bad thing. But I think you've also seen the other side of that coin is that digital has opened up the ability for people to make 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes. If you've got a really great ad, you can let it run as long as you want because you're not held to these 30 seconds or 15 second spaces that networks are trying to enforce on you.
Or, of course, you have Red Bull, the experience disguised as an ad, like in 2012, sending a man to space.
Yeah, that was really, we always joke that how far can extreme advertisers go, these brands that sponsor motocross and snowboarding and extreme everything, and, you know, how much farther can you go? And that's why it was fascinating to see Red Bull actually go to space to take someone up into the stratosphere and drop them and really kind of showed, oh, we're willing to just keep going. And the results of that prove that it's worth doing, that they still got millions and millions of viewers just by YouTube alone, but then they also got traditional TV coverage, and everyone was talking about it because it was an experience that was also an ad, but it was just great to watch.
The moment that had us riveted and millions all over the world watching, this is a space helmet right here, worn by the daredevil Felix Baumgartner as he comes out of his capsule right there, jumping, attempting the highest skydive ever. Free-falling at speeds that surpass 700 miles an hour.
It's easy to be cynical about how much advertising influences our lives and creeps into our lives, you know, from the ads that are playing when we're pumping gas to whatever's coming at us when we log onto a website to read something. But something I thought of when looking at this, just the abundant creativity. What strikes you as you look at this? This is what people with artistic sentiments and sensibilities sort of focused their lives on over the last 40 years.
Well, one thing that kept coming out to me, I spent weeks going back through archives of every Adweek issue I could find. And what was amazing was to see, well, for one, it's just, and I think we all know this, there's just very few amazing ads. There's very few fantastic ads that we're going to talk about and that we're going to be quoting 20 years from now. But what was fascinating is seeing how slowly our culture kind of comes along to those, because it takes us a little while to realize, hey, wait, that's actually pretty amazing, because we have this instinctive barrier of ads are annoying, ads are dumb, and then sometimes we get it right away, but more often I think the best ad campaigns and the best ad ideas were the ones that took a few weeks for everyone from the Adweek writers to the public to the brands themselves to kind of realize we've got something here. This is something that we could end up talking about for years, not just for a few days after it aired on the Super Bowl.
David Greiner, contributing editor for Adweek, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Adweek is celebrating its 35th anniversary with a look back at some of the most pivotal moments in advertising and marketing since it first began publishing in 1978. You'll find a link to look at that slideshow at wordofmouthradio.org.
This stuff. Some cereal. It's supposed to be good for you. Did you try it?
I'm not gonna try it. You try it.
I'm not gonna try it.
Let's get Mikey.
Yeah. He won't need it. He hates everything.
He likes it. Hey, Mikey.
When you bring life home,
admitting to eating a bowl of cereal for dinner is like disclosing that you are lonely, lazy, or way too busy. Similarly, not having the whole family sitting around the table for a hot dinner of protein, a vegetable, and dessert feels like some kind of a failure. Meals are not just food. When did how and what we eat become codified as right, proper, and essentially American? Abigail Carroll is a food historian and author of Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal, which explores the history of America's eating from the colonial era to the present.
In the very early colonial days, for the most part, people were eating a hot meal in the middle of the day, and that's the meal that they called dinner. And they were rising early, they were eating a sort of ad hoc breakfast and an ad hoc supper, which is to say perhaps leftovers from dinner, perhaps heated, but perhaps not, perhaps with others, perhaps alone. Breakfast and supper were very much like glorified snacks. And the dinner often came out of a single pot. You had often one-pot meals. And people were not gathering around a table for dinner and putting on their best manners and catching up about each other's day, because they were often working together on a farm or in a family business, and they didn't have to catch up with each other. They were eating very rustically. It was a while before the fork appeared. And for many years, you know, bread was doing the work of the spoon in terms of sopping up juices and whatnot. People often just put a board across two trestles and brought up a bench, some wooden crates, or simply, you know, squatted or leaned against the wall in the very early days if there wasn't enough chairs for everyone. So the meal looked very different in those days. But it changed quite drastically during the Industrial Revolution.
How did that change? When people moved off the land, obviously not working side by side with each other necessarily in the family anymore, what happened to meals then?
Well, people had to accommodate changing work schedules. You know, they were leaving the farms for factories. They were leaving the country for the city. They were working farther from where they lived, and they couldn't necessarily return home in the middle of the day for a hot meal. And even if they could, you know, if they were working in an office or at a desk, a hot meal would have probably done them in for the rest of the day, such as a farmer's dinner. And so they shifted dinner to the evening when it became really a social time. This is when dinner became special. Dinner also changed from a one-pot meal to, in the 1700s, a kind of pudding and roast type of a meal. And in the 19th century, in the Victorian era, it became a French-inspired meal, which is to say not only French-inspired foods, but perhaps even more importantly, courses. People were starting, with soup. They were ending with dessert. They might have a green salad after their entree. And so dinner looked a lot different then than it had in the colonial period.
You spent a couple of chapters on the rise of dinner to a place of primacy in most of our families and diets. It's come to symbolize a great deal, family unity for one thing, but you give some data on the role it serves even in educating families. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's right. You know, children were not necessarily expected to participate in, you know, dinner time conversation at the table. In the colonial era, there just wasn't a lot of conversation to be had necessarily to begin with. But during the Victorian era, with the emergence of the middle class, this is when families really celebrated formality and etiquette and manners, and they taught their children not to put their elbows on the table, etc. And, you know, children were being trained in what it meant to be middle class, what it meant to be respectable, so that when they grew up and attended a formal dinner party, which was very popular during this era, they would know how to hold their own and they would come across as proper and respectable.
We're speaking with Abigail Carroll. She's a food historian. She's written for several publications like the New York Times and has taught at BU. She's the author of the new book, Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. We have this idea that traditional rituals like the evening meal have been thrown aside by contemporary life. But it's not true. I mean, people didn't always sit at tables. And you also write about the stander-uppers, you know, people who ate standing up and ate separately in many families.
Yeah, well, think about fast food. The origins of fast food are really the quick lunch. So very late 19th century and early 20th century, this is when you have people working in cities, at factories, and lunch has really come to fill in that gap now between breakfast and dinner when, you know, dinner shifted to the evening. And because dinner was so special, lunch didn't have to be. And so lunch was really this stopgap meal. It was emphasis on quick, on often cold, although not always, and cheap. And that was, of course, so that you could get right back to work and that you could be productive and that you could be profitable. And so the quick lunch venue emerges. This is when cafeterias emerge and eventually automats where, you know, you can just drop a coin in a slot, open a door, take out your pie. And the idea of eating in 20 minutes or 15, in some cases five, not even sitting down. Many of these places didn't even have tables. They had chairs. Think about a classroom where you have the sort of desk as part of the chair as one unit. Well, they had these what they called one-armed joints. A one-armed joint was a restaurant that you would go to where you could grab your food cafeteria style, bring it to a chair that had a wraparound table, a little depression for your coffee cup, and you could wolf it down without the, you know, need to socialize or waste time talking with anybody.
Why cereal, eggs, and pancakes for breakfast, but never for lunch or dinner?
Well, breakfast used to be one of those meals where it didn't matter what you ate. There weren't specific foods you associated just with breakfast. You had leftovers for breakfast. And in the 1800s, you often had a breakfast that looked a lot more like dinner because meat became very central to breakfast. And you might have porridge with your meat or breakfast cakes such as muffins or biscuits. But in the mid to late 19th century, with the Industrial Revolution and the change in lifestyles, people couldn't eat that farmer's breakfast anymore because it just made for a bad case of indigestion. And so this is when health reformers such as Sylvester Graham and later John Harvey Kellogg were experimenting with the farinaceous breakfast, which is to say the grain-based breakfast. And breakfast cereal is invented at sanitariums where people went to seek health from various maladies, namely indigestion. And then breakfast cereal colonizes a meal and becomes iconic of that meal.
Well, of course, the history of how we eat in America is never far from how food has been marketed in America. What are some other places where good old entrepreneurial opportunism played into the invention of the American meal?
Well, the first thing, of course, that comes to mind is breakfast cereal. But, of course, with snacking, that's really where entrepreneurialism comes in. You have people who are initially just peddling snack foods on the streets, pretzel peddlers and peanut peddlers and people selling popcorn at fairs and circuses and political rallies. And this was a way that a lot of immigrants, you know, made it. They were dirt poor, but they made it in this country in the New World by selling perhaps a food that they brought with them, such as the pretzel being brought from Germany. But then many of them went into business. I think of the two brothers, immigrants from Germany, who started Cracker Jack in Chicago. They were the first, really, to take a snack food and process it, basically manufacture it, you know, manufacture it on an industrial scale, and put it in a box. And when they put it in a box, it just took on new characteristics. One of the things that happened when they put it in a box was that it was seen as cleaner, purer, and basically less suspicious, because snack food had become stigmatized as being associated with rather unhygienic, dirt-poor immigrants with different cultural standards, and perhaps because of their different cultural standards, different health standards and hygienic standards.
Well, Abigail, you're a food historian. This obviously isn't the first time that you've considered what you're eating, but I wonder, after writing this book and looking at the specifics of how meals have been shaped, but also how they influence our culture, I'm wondering, when you sit down to eat, what are you thinking about?
I think about how little we think about the meal and how entrenched our eating patterns are and how entrenched our sense of what we think we should eat is. You know, when I say that I have soup for breakfast perhaps one day, I think it's very, very jarring for people and very rare to come across somebody who would eat for breakfast something that's not considered a standard breakfast food. And this is, you know, not the case throughout the world. Not everybody eats quote unquote breakfast foods for breakfast, but I've seen just how deep those roots are.
Abigail Carroll, author of Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much, Virginia.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Do employees work harder when they are paid more? A new study out of Harvard set out to answer that very question and came away with some interesting conclusions. One, that employers should consider not just what they pay workers, but how. Cash bonuses increase employee productivity more than raises in salaries, even if the amount of the bump is exactly the same. Duncan Gilchrist is a PhD student studying business economics at Harvard and co-author of the study. Duncan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So first, some background. What had economic thinking on how wages affected performance been in the past?
So labor economists have typically observed that some employers pay above market wages. So that is to say, some employers would kind of pay above the minimum wage or required wage to hire a worker for a job. Experimental economists have been trying to understand why that might be the case. And there's been mixed evidence historically about when paying more than a worker expected might change the way they perform. And so we were exploring exactly that.
So with that in mind, how did you conduct the study?
So we hired about 260 workers on an online labor market called Odesk, which basically lets you hire freelancers from around the world. And what we did with those workers is we hired one group at $3 per hour. These workers are all from low-wage countries, and so $3 per hour was above what they normally charge. And we also hired one group of workers for $4 an hour. And comparing the output of those two workers showed that they actually performed very similarly. We couldn't distinguish between how well they performed. But simultaneously, we hired a third group of workers, and we paid those workers $3 per hour when we hired them. But as soon as they accepted the job, we said, actually, wait, we have a larger budget than expected. We'll pay you $4 an hour. And those workers, which we kind of call our gift treatment, because they received the unexpected gift of a higher wage, performed significantly better than the other two groups.
How significantly? Any quantification here?
Yeah. So they performed about 20% better on average, bearing in mind that they were paid 33% more than the $3 per hour workers. But at the same time, some groups of those workers actually performed substantially better. So the workers who had the most experience and who had worked most recently on the Odesk platform actually performed even better than the average gift-receiving worker. And basically, we find that the people for whom the gift is most salient, for whom the gift is most surprising, responded the most. The way we've been approaching this is that the workers kind of saw the job at the wage we offered them in the beginning and assumed that that was the kind of going rate for the job. So if we offered them $4 an hour, they assumed that was just the way we would pay people. But when we offered them $3 an hour and then actually just gave them this unexpected $1 an hour gift, they saw that as kind of a generous act on our part and reciprocated with a more generous effort.
Well, maybe that's a question. Unexpected generosity leads to unexpected hard work is what I'm seeing. So would a cash bonus that came along annually make any difference?
No, that's exactly kind of what we've been thinking about. You know, there's cash bonuses that come along annually are very much in the expected gift category, mm-hmm. similar to our $4 an hour treatment. That's just kind of part of the salary that a worker might receive. But there are also kind of non-monetary incentives like recognition or respect or autonomy that employers can provide to their workers in less expected ways. And we think that those can provide fairly powerful motivators of behavior.
Is this why signing bonuses have become so attractive, do you think?
I think that's a tough question. I think signing bonuses are in part very attractive. And bear in mind that signing bonuses happen often well before you start work.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are more just to motivate you to take the offer right away and maybe not try to seek out other employment offers or kind of competing places of work.
So Duncan, what is the takeaway for a company which wants to increase productivity?
I think the takeaway is that the structure of the way you pay employees might really matter. And so instead of bumping up everyone's wage 1% when you have more money, you might think more about how to structure that 1% to actually benefit the employees in different ways. A gift may be better than a bump in the base wage.
Well, Duncan Gilchrist, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Duncan Gilchrist is pursuing a PhD at the Harvard Business School and is co-author of Gift Structure and Reciprocity in the Field. That's a study of how cash bonuses and gifts affect job performance. There's a link to read a summary of the study at wordofmouthradio.org. We asked the Word of Mouth community to tell us what they would prefer, cash bonus or an equivalent raise in salary. Word of Mouth's Facebook fans were quick to choose an annual raise over a cash gift of the same amount. Melody speculated that taxes on a cash bonus could be higher. Maureen pointed out that salary raises compound year after year. And Terry cheated a little. She asked, why can't we all have both? We also heard from listeners via our Word of Mouth hotline, where responses were split.
You have new messages. New message.
Hi, my name is Toby Theodore, and I live in Greenfield, New Hampshire, right next to Peterborough. And I'm going to go with a lump sum. And my reason for that is because I think with more cash on hand rather than it coming in slow, there's more that I could immediately do with that cash to benefit myself than steadily adding money to my income over time. But that's just my opinion. Okay, bye-bye.
Hi, my name's Mimi. I'm from Derry, New Hampshire. And it would seem to me that your better long-term strategy would be to take the raise, not the bonus, because raises are usually calculated as a percentage of your current salary. So the more your salary, the higher your overall raise. Thank you.
Hi, this is Dan from Somersworth. My preference would be for an increase in weekly or biweekly pay rather than a lump sum. Thanks.
Jeff McKenna from Walpole, New Hampshire. About a bonus versus salary increase, it's obvious, always take the bonus. You could lose your job tomorrow, but once you've cashed the check, the money will always be yours. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you to everybody who called or left a message online. We invite you to contribute to the conversation. It's already taking place on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Chances are you came into contact with something made from recycled material today, a can of soda, the carpeting in your office building, or the smartphone that is pretty much an arm's length or less away most of the day. They are all part of a swirling cycle of goods made from old items that get fed back into the production of new stuff. And the more we buy, the more we need to recycle. But where does all of that recycled material ultimately end up? Adam Minter is Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview and a frequent contributor to The Atlantic and other publications. He followed the trail of trash and found that most of it ends up in China and India. He's author of Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. And Adam, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
A billion-dollar trash trade. Who is profiting from all that waste?
Well, it's everybody from the local scrapyard down the street in New Hampshire there to large-scale exporters of scrap metal and paper on the West and East Coast ports like Los Angeles and in New Jersey. And more than ever, it's Chinese scrap metal importers and processors, the people who are bringing in it's just $40 billion of American recyclables annually and transforming them into products that range, as you said, from cardboard boxes to automobile parts. It's an extraordinary story. It's the hidden story of globalization, and it's only growing.
The scale is huge. But my question, why does the U.S. export that waste to places like China instead of just recycling it here?
Sure. Well, the simple answer is that the U.S. just simply generates more recycling, more waste than it's capable of processing at home. On average, the U.S. exports about 40% of the recycling that it generates. And most of that recycling isn't despite what most people may think, put into your recycling bin. It's recycling that's generated in factories, printing plants, by power companies when they replace new cables. And a lot of that kind of material, it's just too much excess of it to be handled in a U.S. manufacturing facility. So, for example, in China, they have the largest copper manufacturing industry in the world. So if you have a power line, more likely than not, that power line was manufactured in China. And so, in a sense, the story of recycling today is a story not just about recycling, but it's about manufacturing. As we all know, China's become the manufacturing juggernaut of the world, and because of that, it needs raw materials, and recycled materials are the cheapest and most efficient raw materials out there.
Is there an alternative to sending waste overseas? What you do in the book is paint this pretty stark scenario, environmentally speaking, an increase in mining for ore. So talk to us a little bit about those trade-offs.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that I state in the book, and I believe it quite strongly, is the worst recycling, and there's some very environmentally damaging recycling, is still better than the best mining. And by that I mean, simply this. Digging a hole in, a Tibetan mountainside to dig out copper ore is an invariably very, very destructive and very dangerous activity. It's far safer and far cleaner to ship a bunch of power lines from the United States to South China, where they can be stripped, not necessarily in factories that meet, U.S. health and safety standards, but certainly much healthier, safer, and much less environmentally destructive than digging massive holes in the ground. And that goes for plastics, which require some very dangerous facilities to recycle, but they tend to be lighter on the environment than digging an oil well, say, in the South China Sea. These are very hard, decisions and very hard choices that, we all have to face as consumers and as people who consume raw materials. They're not black and white, despite how they tend to be depicted in the mainstream media that, exporting your recycling to China is bad. Mm. As I tell people, China is going to manufacture stuff. They're going to make new iPhones. They're going to print books, and they're going to get the raw materials to do that. So we have to ask ourselves, how would we like them to get those raw materials? If we cut off the flow of recycling from the U.S. to China, they're going to go get those raw materials somewhere else. I think there are ways to encourage China to do better, and they have been doing better in the 11 years I've covered the industry. There's a long way to go, but compared to what the situation could be, I think the recycling system is very good.
Well, Adam, one of the things that just shocked me is how many people in the world are employed in this recycling business.
Yeah.
Can you give us any idea of the numbers?
Well, the actual numbers are really hard to come by, and they're really variable because it depends on how you look at it. But after agriculture, the activity which occupies more people than any other in the developing world is recycling. And that may be just going through people's trash bins and working as a peddler, because that's basically the job opportunity of last resort, to working in some of the highly industrial facilities that I show in the book, both in pictures and write about. So if you can come up with total agricultural employment, it's a number less than that. And it's just absolutely astonishing. The longer you spend in the developing world, how many people you actually see engaged in this.
We're speaking with Adam Minter, Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview and author of the new book, Junkyard Planet: Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. How has the global economic crisis that began in 2008 affected the scrap export industry here in the U.S.?
Well, 2008 was a watershed moment for the global scrap industry, and especially for the U.S. industry itself. For the better part of 15 years, the U.S. industry had grown significantly because of China's demand for raw materials. But when the global economy collapsed, China's demand for raw materials collapsed. Remember, China's an export economy. They need markets to sell the stuff they make, everything from, the iPhones to the books they print. Well, when U.S. consumers and EU consumers stopped buying all that stuff, the Chinese stopped demanding raw materials, and as a result, all of the recyclables that had been flowing to China basically stopped. And you had a situation in the U.S. where recycling warehouses were filling up with cardboard with nowhere to send it, because the Chinese simply didn't need it anymore. And a lot of people were appalled, towards the end of 2008. These recycling warehouses simply didn't have anywhere else to send the stuff, so they started sending it to landfills and incinerators. And that was also something that was occurring in the EU. To this day, as we all know, the global economy hasn't completely recovered from 2008, and neither, for that matter, have scrap exports from the U.S. or the EU. They still lag from where they were in 2007, which was the biggest year ever of the global recycling industry. You know, if things continue as they do, it looks like things will be back to normal, or whatever normal means, in 2014, 2015. But it's, you know, as I said earlier, the story of globalized recycling is really a story of manufacturing, and that's a story of how much people want to consume. In 2008, people stopped consuming, and as a result, the world stopped recycling.
How about now, though, Adam? You're giving us this picture of what you call sludge-filled landfills, burning plastic, you know, a picture that we don't necessarily want to see when we're buying mm-hmm. something on the supermarket shelves. And recently, you had an interview with Atlantic Cities and said, stop buying so much crap in the first place. Can I just say cynically, good luck with that. You know, are we really going to jam up the system, especially if there's so much legacy waste?
Oh, I agree with you completely. I mean, I want an iPhone upgrade, too. You know, I want a new car, too, you know. And I also feel that people in China and India should have the right to those things as well. There's no getting around getting people to stop buying stuff. What I encourage people to do, and I encourage them towards the end of the book, is start thinking about products that last longer, that can be repaired and upgraded, that don't need to be cycled out every 18 months. In the end, you're only holding off the garbage man and the recycling man for a little while longer, but it's a more practical approach, shall I say, than, you know, telling people to stop buying so much crap. But when I said that to the Atlantic Cities, I was sort of getting at that point.
Adam, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Adam Minter is Shanghai correspondent for the Bloomberg Worldview. His new book is called Junkyard Planet, and we do have a link to read an excerpt from the book. It was published in The Atlantic. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Children's book writer and illustrator David Wiesner is a three-time winner of the Caldecott Medal for Most Distinguished Children's Picture Book, first in 1992 for his book Tuesday, a decade later for his wondrous reimagining of The Three Little Pigs, and finally in 2007 for the inventive, visually rich Flotsam. His newest work is about a group of tiny extraterrestrial explorers whose wee spaceship unwittingly becomes a plaything for a house cat named Mr. Waffles. As with all of Wiesner's books, Mr. Waffles is nearly wordless, with dramatic visuals that propel readers from the plausible and everyday into the fantastical world of what could happen. David, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Virginia.
I was wondering what a reading is like with you, since your books are nearly wordless.
Well, that's the interesting thing about the wordless book, is that it doesn't have the author's voice, the text, there, so that everyone who reads it can read it however they want. And I basically take people through sort of the journey of the story, describe what I think the characters are saying, what they're thinking, describe the action. I've heard people do voices, people making sound effects. It's really a wide open kind of active interpretation on the part of the reader.
And let's look at Mr. Waffles in particular. You have said that the concept was inspired by a cover that you did for Cricket magazine in 1993. Can you describe that cover and tell us how it led you to Mr. Waffles?
The cover was a flying saucer that had landed in the desert, sort of, you know, half buried in there. And the crew had come out and they had their flag and they were all standing around getting their picture taken after their, you know, successful landing here on Earth. So you saw the sand dunes and there was a camel in the front. But when you opened up the back cover to see the complete image, you realized that, in fact, they were not in the desert. They were in a sandbox. So I thought I could make a story out of this image and turn it into a book. And as it turned out, I couldn't. I put it aside because it ultimately just wasn't happening.
So then along wanders Mr. Waffles. We see him in the beginning of the book. He's bored with all of his toys, these feathered toys and badminton birdies and little mice. They all have price tags coming off of them, except this one little tiny spaceship.
That's right. And I was drawing that spaceship. This is years later in my sketchbook, and I drew it with all this interesting texture, these kind of like pointy little things. And I thought about it, and I said, oh, my cat would love to scratch its neck on this. What a neat cat toy. And that suddenly unleashed the story from a completely different perspective while retaining many of the things that I had originally been drawn to about it. So when I was least expecting it, there it was. And immediately was this relationship between this cat, typical cat, ornery kind of cat, who discovers the thing that it is absolutely fascinated with, which is not a cat toy, but it is in fact a real little flying saucer.
And the fate of what happens to those little teeny extraterrestrials and their, I don't know, I guess it's like it becomes the cave of Lascaux behind the radiator.
And that popped out as I was, the story was finally coming together. It was just sort of flowing, and it's always great to be able to take the story another level deeper. And when I had them go and hide under the radiator to escape the cat, suddenly it was, well, what else is back there? And this whole world behind the baseboard where the bugs live, and they've been chronicling their trials and tribulations and battles with Mr. Waffles on the walls, just like those prehistoric caves in Lascaux, which, of course, you know, these two races can now relate to each other despite their language barrier, that they've both been, terrorized by this cat. So they immediately set about having snacks and getting their picture taken and devising a plan to thwart the cat.
You're known for using 3D models and sculptures to help create a sense of realism in your drawings. I'm wondering how you did that to capture the physicality of Mr. Waffles in this book.
Looking at something is the best way to draw it. Drawing is about seeing and understanding its shape. So I always am making models of things. They're fairly rudimentary, but it gives an immense amount of visual information that I can translate into my drawings to make them, you know, more convincing, not photorealistic, but to create a believable world. In the case of Mr. Waffles, I had a friend actually sew up a robe to put on about an 8-inch high wooden figure. The aliens wear these long robes. So I really want to see how that fabric will, you know, bend and bunch up and move as the characters are moving or running or lying down or sitting, and how the light hits it. That's just all information that I can use to make that world inside a spaceship more believable. For my cat, though, you know, your memory's never good enough, but I created what I refer to as the cat cam, a small video camera that I put on a pole that I was able to walk around with it right down at the floor level, which is where the action of the book takes place, and follow my cat around, and, you know, while it sat and washed and did all these things, and I, you know, kind of chased it around and stuff so that I could, you know, really observe how they move, their body language, the gestures, to try to capture that sense of the catness of the cat.
Mr. Waffles differs from many of your other books in that there is dialogue, but only most of it is written in the alien language or the bug language. Do you have any idea what they're saying, or is that a mystery even to you?
You know, I have a sense. I love the idea of making a book full of dialogue that nobody could read. And I didn't want to create a glossary in the back that defines what they're saying. Basically, the pictures, the context of the pictures transmits what's going on from facial expressions and body language. But there is some consistency within this language. I spoke with a linguist for a while about doing this. And so you'll notice the triangle is kind of their all-purpose exclamation. Sometimes it's if they're scared, or sometimes if they're excited. There's modifiers in front of it, but it's kind of always there in the right circumstances. There's a little character in green who is, I think of as the ship's engineer or the, you know, science officer, kind of like Scotty from Star Trek, and figured that this character would speak in technical jargon all the time. So if you look at the word balloons associated with him, they have the most symbols in it. They're almost like fractions with a numerator and a denominator. So there's visual clues about the way they're speaking and the things that they're saying. But the specifics of it are left to the imagination, of the reader.
David Wiesner, a pleasure to speak with you on Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been great.
David Wiesner is the multiple award-winning children's book author and illustrator. His newest book is called Mr. Waffles. There's more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for spending some time with us today. We do invite you to share what you heard with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep catalog of conversations to listen to post on social media, or to email on to your friends. And let us know what you're curious about, the stories or the sources that you find interesting or that stick in your head. What is scratching at that sense of wonder in you? We find that the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. Let's keep on sharing them. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Bill Berry,
and Zach Nugent.
Our intern is
James Pouliot.
Digital support from Rebecca Lavoie
and Sarah Plord.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.